From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you've ever read a book by the novelist David Mitchell, you know that he's...
John!
Katie, I'm reading intro here.
I know, John. I wrote it. We have to talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, Soundcheck producer Katie Bishop, and wait, the whole Soundcheck staff?
Hi, John.
I think you know why we're here.
Hurt myself.
What was that?
I sprained my ankle playing soccer, all right?
It's not just the fact that you sprained your ankle playing soccer this morning. It's that you were playing soccer before work, at God knows what hour of the morning, with God knows who, on a weekday, John.
So what? Now you're doing an intervention? Here? Now? I'm out of here.
John Schaefer, you sit down right now.
Does Joel know about this? Because I bet our executive producer would be interested to know that you've hijacked...
Joel organized this intervention, John, but he couldn't be here himself. He couldn't stand it. He went to pieces over your latest soccer incident.
John, when you play soccer on a weekday morning and sprain your ankle and you have to ice it for half an hour and you're almost late for taping an interview, it makes me feel like you don't care about the interview. And you're always limping around the office. I don't know what you do out on that field.
Okay, my turn, John. I sometimes felt like you weren't even here during the summer during the World Cup.
Well, I wasn't here. I was down in the WNYC lunchroom watching the games with the other normal people at the station. I got my work done.
John, all you need to do right now is listen. Dan, it's your turn.
John, whenever we book a band from England, you always want to talk about the Premier League. After the interview is over, you talk about soccer for 10, 15, sometimes 20 minutes. They're just rock bands, John. They have places to go. They have gigs. They have lives. Can't you understand that not every British person knows something about Arsenal?
Dan, this is a safe place. No judgments. Do it like we practiced.
I feel like soccer is getting in the way of our bands getting to the Bowery Ballroom on time. I want my host back.
Wow, I never knew you felt that way, Dan, or you, Mike, or Katie, that everyone felt that way. I just thought a soccer game here or there wouldn't get in the way. And really, after all, what British person doesn't know about Arsenal? They're the best team in the world.
John.
They just acquired Danny Welbeck.
John.
Alexis Sanchez is playing better than ever.
John!
Jesus Christ.
Fine. David Mitchell is the author of books like Ghostwritten, Cloud Atlas, and his latest, The Bone Clocks. It's a time-leaping story that blends the very real with the very fantastical, and it also includes quite a few musical references. So we have asked David Mitchell to join us on Soundcheck today with a Pick 3 playlist. Hi, David.
Thank you very much, John. Great to be here.
So it doesn't take long for a reader of The Bone Clocks to start getting the message that music is important to the characters and presumably to you.
Oh, yes, yeah. I think our tastes in music give information about who we are and what we love and rather like our clothes or even in extreme cases, John, our choice of football team. I stand in an Arsenal man, which tells me all about you that I need to know, matey.
says the Liverpool fan.
John!
He started it! All right, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I do think about the music a lot, and I couldn't imagine a life without music and wouldn't want to. It's one of the great reasons to be alive, that food and a number of other things, yeah.
And page one... First page of the novel, we are introduced to a character who is in love with the third record by Talking Heads, the album Fear of Music.
Yeah.
Was this an important record to you?
It's a fabulous record. It sounds better now than it did then. For me, it was a record that taught me that rock, pop music can be cerebral. It can invite you to think. And swing, and have rhythm, and have that propulsive force and that transporting force that the best music does. But until I met this record, and of course I was about 12, 13 years old at the time, but I didn't realise that music can do what books also invite you to do, to think and to take you on a kind of a story or a journey, and do more than that. If literature could do exactly what music does, then you wouldn't need music.
But it's, and possibly vice versa.
Oh, yeah, 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 for sure. Writers are often very jealous of musicians. They get to perform in front of their audience rather than absently at long distance, at great removes in time and space. I think most writers secretly fantasize at
not
some point.
Not so secretly.
Or not so secretly.
The first time Jonathan Lethem was on our show, he just came out and said, if I could write a song, I wouldn't write novels. If I could write songs, that's what I would do.
That is characteristically honest of Jonathan.
Yeah. We meet right out of the box in the book. There are many, many characters with important roles to play, but Holly Sykes is kind of our through line. She's 15 when we meet her. She's in love, she thinks, and she's got this record. And the song that she's particularly keen on is one that actually, the theme of this song sort of comes back later on in the book. But let's hear a little bit of the song Heaven. Talking Heads from their 1979 album Fear of Music. The song is Heaven, which is mentioned early in David Mitchell's book called The Bone Clocks, and then mentioned again later, a couple hundred pages later, just kind of in passing. Holly is still talking about Talking Heads many, many years later. But there is a moment, I think it's on page 2 or 3, where Holly takes that record and she tosses it into the river. And reading that, I got to tell you, reading that, I had the same reaction as if she had burned a book. It was just like, no,
don't take it out on the record. Yeah. Well, she had an unfortunate experience with the young man who you alluded to earlier, John, who she thought she was in love with, and as that record was a sort of a love gift from him early on in their relationship, she has taken it out on the record, and it's probably still there somewhere on the bed of the River Thames.
That album, as with the second and the fourth Talking Heads albums, that album was produced by Brian Eno. Mm. Are you a fan of his?
Yeah, I am. He's great writing music. It's non-vocal. You can't work when someone is singing anything in a language that you have any knowledge of at all. And it needs to be stimulating enough to sort of propel you and to keep you working, but not so stimulating that it yanks you out of the rather meditative state that writing is. Yet still stimulating enough that if you drop out, it'll just gently nudge you back. So Eno and Bach are my two great writing companions, actually.
So you do listen to that music while in the process, in the act of writing.
Yeah. You kind of choose your music rather like I choose my tea. It depends where I am in the book and what mood I'm in and what the weather's doing that particular day. But oddly enough, when I'm at a sort of conceptual stage in the work, then I like relatively conceptual music. But if I'm, say, proofreading in the last stages, then somewhat more taxing music or more music with more music in it, if that makes sense, is helpful then.
So, you know, you mentioned some of Eno's ambient music, which he actually wrote should be as ignorable as it is interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a funny way, it echoes what we just heard in the Talking Heads song. You know, heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. Eno's music for airports is, you know, for
a place where nothing ever happens.
Yeah.
You just kind of... Yet it's brilliant. Yet, and that's the mystery at the heart of that music. How can something basically without a melody, basically without a direction, still? It's like a sonic stained glass window. It's sort of all there at once, and it's beautiful, but it doesn't stop you doing other things as well. It just sort of enhances. It enhances your hour. It's mysterious, isn't it?
Yeah. And you can write about it till the cows come home and still not, you know, and that's one of the great things about music is just how elusive it is.
Yes, yeah.
David Mitchell's with us on Soundcheck sharing his Pick 3 playlist. One of the songs, the one from Talking Heads, appears in the book The Bone Clocks. The other two do not, but before we get to those, David, I wanted to ask you about a band that is referenced a couple of times in the book, and that is the KLF.
Right. Each of the sections of the novel is set in a distinct decade, and so I try to texture that novella with contemporary references from popular culture. If you're writing about the 90s, and there's a scene in the novel set in Switzerland in a kind of a 90s Euro club, then the KLF seemed entirely appropriate. So in they went.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the KLF, their big international hit of 1991 called 3 AM Eternal. KLF is gonna rock ya. KLF is the name of that British band. 3 AM Eternal was a big hit for them in the early 90s and appears in David Mitchell's latest novel called The Bone Clocks. David's with us here in the Soundcheck studio today. So the structure of the novel is kind of unusual, as it was with Cloud Atlas before. You refer to it as six novellas, is that right?
Yeah.
All intertwined and... this might be a sign versus thing signified kind of question, but when you do, you know, sprinkle music in, whether it's popular music or, you know, someone's talking about Bruckner's Ninth or, you know, Maria Callas singing Traviata, you know, do they tell us something about these characters? Do the songs, are they chosen for that kind of effect?
They're never chosen at random. They're always chosen with a lot of thought and research. It adds texture to not only the novellas, but to the characters who love that music. This isn't an original invention, of course.
Right, right.
Murakami does it a lot.
Then my follow-up question is, you're all over the map stylistically in this book. There are classical pieces, opera, you know, pop music of many different stripes. You're asking a lot of your listeners to be able to pick up on those cues that you're dropping.
I don't think, and it would be impossible really, or certainly unrealistic to expect all readers to know all this music. But I don't think that's totally necessary. You can sort of make generalizations about someone who is referencing a relatively obscure classical reference or jazz without needing necessarily to know the music. And that's one of the reasons why God invented the internet as well, of course. You can just go and listen to it these days.
Absolutely. Now, the Pick 3 playlist that you brought us today, we started with Talking Heads, who are in the novel. Duke Pearson is next. Not in the novel, but what do you like about this?
Well, he's in my first novel. He's in Ghostwritten. I reference that piece of music there. It's this music's called After the Rain, and it makes me smell a garden after the rain. It's a rare piece of music. It actually triggers that part of my brain that uses that's sensitive to smell, to fragrance. Huh. And I just walk through when I hear this, especially when the flute starts. I can I'm in a garden all wet with rain, and I've been. This piece of music for me is a place, and I've been to this place. I've been listening to it maybe 30 years. This piece of music's been in my life.
Duke Pearson and After the Rain, the jazz pianist, Blue Note producer, and a favorite of my guest, David Mitchell, author of the new book, The Bone Clocks. You mentioned that Duke Pearson appears in Ghostwritten.
Yeah.
And so do, not that they're in Ghostwritten, but this kind of bringing characters, you know, referencing things that you've written before, happens in the new book as well.
Yes, it does. Maybe more in this one than any of my other books. I'm sort of more self-consciously, in a way, making this other universe made up of my books. It's not that I'm doing prequels or sequels. Sort of the first principle is that each book has to be a standalone that could theoretically be the first thing of mine you've ever read, and it needs to work in and of itself. But if you have read other books, then you will recognise major characters in other novels making brief appearances here, or minor characters like Hugo Lamb, who just exists in a book I wrote some years ago called Black Swan Green, and he's only a very minor character there, but he's sort of the joint second most important protagonist in this one.
Right. And then there's Dr. Marinus, or Marinus, however you pronounce it.
Marinus is
fine. Marinus. Who also appears in your opera libretto.
Oh, well researched. Not many people know that.
I have done some work with Michel van der Aa.
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. He emailed me this morning.
Yeah. He's the composer of Sunken Garden. You're the librettist. So obviously you do more than just listen to music. You've been you've been down in the trenches with the composer.
Well, he made it very easy for me. He just asked me to write the words first, and he worked the music around it. But you can learn a lot from musicians and from composers.
Now, how different an experience is that, telling a story through an opera libretto, from a series of intertwined or interlocked novellas or a sprawling novel?
Well, you have to do less, which sounds easier. Not necessarily, because that less has to be less, which is more. You don't have control over anything but the words, actually, whereas with a book, now, if you're describing a storm, then it's your job to describe it and to animate it and to make it work on the page, whereas in a libretto you can just write the words, a storm.
Right.
And then it's someone else's job to make it work. Of course, every word has to count.
Yeah.
Every line, every phrase has to earn its living within the greater whole, whereas novels are necessarily baggier, more capacious, more forgiving, maybe more generous forms.
Well, your latest is certainly a generous one. The Bone Clocks is the latest novel by David Mitchell, who's been sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us here on Soundcheck today. So your third pick, which we'll conclude with, Patrick Watson, the Canadian musician and songwriter.
Yeah.
What do you like about his work and The Great Escape?
His voice is just one of those you immediately arresting, distinctive voices. It's truffles, it's dark coffee, it's velvety. It's just a beautiful, divine gift of a voice. And this song in particular, for me, this song, it's one of those examples where you bring a meaning to a piece of music, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. It's reading. It's called The Great Escape, and for me, a book is a great escape. No matter what else is going on in your life, if the book is working for you, then all books, in a way, are wardrobes into Narnia. They're all ways into another world, and you come back somehow refreshed and able to see things in a different way. Reading's a great gift, like music.
Well, let's hear The Great Escape from Patrick Watson. David Mitchell, thank you so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
I've had a great time. Thank you for having me.
Bad day, looking for a way home, looking for the great escape. Gets in his car and drives away, far from all the things that we are. Puts on a smile and breathes it in and breathes it out. He says bye, bye, bye to all of us.
This week we've been asking Soundcheck listeners to suggest songs for our funniest playlist ever. Comedians Eugene Merman and Hari Kondabolu gave us their picks, and so did you. So up next on the show, we'll play a few of the best and most hilarious. If you're driving or operating heavy machinery, you might want to lay off for the next couple of minutes, as hilarity ensues next on Soundcheck.
I'm Margot from Boreham Hill in Brooklyn. The first album I bought with my own money was Oops, I Did It Again by Britney Spears.
I think I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. Oh, baby, it might seem like a crush.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and once again, joining me in the studio, Soundcheck producers Katie Bishop and Dan O'Donnell. So, I did a whole interview with a guy from England, and I really didn't mention soccer once.
We're very proud of you, John.
All right, thank you.
And now that the intervention is over and we all feel like we've been heard, let's have a good laugh and talk about this project we've been running all week. Soundcheck listeners, we've been asking for your picks for funniest songs ever. And you have not disappointed. And maybe also some of the grossest songs ever, which we can maybe talk about in a little bit.
I'm looking at you, John Schaefer.
Well, now, I want to take you all back to Monday when we started on this little adventure. And I said, I know what the funniest song ever made is. And you were all like, oh, no, that's too disgusting. You're not playing this song on the radio. Well, now you have to let me, because our listener Tony called in and nominated that very song.
You're asking about songs that are very funny. Well, I can't even think of the song without cracking up, and that is Screamin' Jay Hawkins singing Constipation Blues. And I think that's just, the first time I heard that song, I just could not stop laughing, and I still laugh every time I hear it.
I know, it's kind of gross. But you're all laughing. Irene's in there laughing. Everyone is laughing. And look, seriously, here is why it's funny. This is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, right? The guy who became famous for I Put a Spell on You.
It's Gruntin' Jay Hawkins.
But see, this is the thing. When this guy sang a love song or a ballad, he sang it from the gut. He was moaning and grunting and groaning and screaming because love is painful. And here he is in this song, and he never mentions, you know, bodily functions or anything, but there he is. He's grunting and groaning and screaming and moaning, and all you need is the title.
We'll allow it. Although I have to say, since you've broken the dam, we do have to say that scatological humor, you know, there is its whole subgenre unto itself. We did have one listener, Richard from Cortland Manor, suggest a song by Donovan called Intergalactic Laxative.
Now, see, I would think that someone who lived in a place as Tony sounding as Cortland Manor would not stoop to such a thing. But what did Richard say?
Well, he just said that it's very funny, and then I went and listened to the song because, to be honest, I had never heard it before. And The intergalactic part is truth in advertising, for sure. It addresses the motions of heavenly bodies, if you will. But we really can't even go there on the air.
Katie, you got one from large listener pool?
I'm not going to go the route that you two are going, but we did get some really funny ones. I think earlier in the week you were talking about the unintentionally funny songs the really interesting ones and also really funny ones. Our listener Darren called in.
This is Darren from Paramus. The song I think is the funniest that I can remember is John Travolta singing Gonna Let Her In, probably from 1976, I'd say. He sings it off-key, and it's just a horrible, funny ballad, and I laugh every time I hear it.
Okay, so John Travolta?
John Travolta. So first of all, I never even knew that John Travolta had any sort of like solo album. I just think of
maybe
him as like Grease.
Maybe there's a reason for that.
Right. So I look at this American Bandstand performance that he does. First of all, wearing the like amazing 70s orange turtleneck with the necklace over it. He's probably like 20 years old. And clearly lip syncing the most boring song, and all these girls are just dying over it. But it is a truly terrible song, and there is a reason that no one has ever heard of this song ever again.
Gonna open up after so long, gonna open up after so long, with my feet stuck on the ground and my head against the wall. I've been called and I can't answer why.
Oh wow, yeah. That is painful.
I mean, John Travolta's had some embarrassing moments even recently, but that, I think, maybe tops the list.
Wow, that, all right, Darren, good call. That really is an unintentionally hilarious song. Any others that were kind of surprising that way?
Well, you know, our listener Kyle left us a comment on our website, and he suggested two songs. He says Spice Girls Wannabe is hilarious. Kyle, no, it's not. Spice Girls Wannabe is a masterpiece. But he also said that Seal's Kiss from a Rose is hilarious, which it is. It is such a weird song. Do you know this song, John?
Of course I know the song. Yeah. It was a huge hit.
Right. But if you really think about it, first of all, it makes no sense.
It's,
like, Kiss from a Rose? Like, what? And then I always thought he was saying, this came out when I was, like, 9 years old, and all I think about is being at the orthodontist hearing this song. But I always thought it was...
I remember being at grade school dances, and it probably felt the same as being at the orthodontist.
Right.
But
painful. But, you know, I always thought he was saying Kiss by a Rose. I thought he was saying, like, On the Grave or...
I thought it was
rain?
On the Way or something.
He's
like...
saying On the Gray?
On the Gray?
It just doesn't make any sense. And the video, there's two videos for the song. One is him being a creepy photographer. The other one is him. This song was a big part of the movie Batman Forever.
Right.
And there's this mashup of him and like the Batman symbol and see like cuts from the Batman movie. It's just it's a weird song, and I don't think it's held up that well, and it is pretty funny.
All right, so Katie thinks it's funny, and our listener Kyle thinks it's funny. What do you folks think?
There used to be a graying tower alone on the sea. You became the light on the dark side of me. Love remains a drug that's the high and not the pill. But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become large and the light that you shine can't be seen. Baby, I'd like to pay you to a kiss from a rose on the grave.
I'm going to say that any song that begins with an oboe in the entrance also might qualify.
All right, so some find that an amusing little number from Seal.
I know that you have a pick that has just as much fine harmonizing on it from a little more contemporary duo.
Well, you know, a couple of our listeners did mention Flight of the Conchords. And as I've said a couple of times this week, for me, the most interesting ones are the ones that weren't meant to be really funny. Obviously, Flight of the Conchords is meant to be funny, but they're just so good at it, you know? And we had various people requesting or nominating different songs for our Funniest Songs Ever playlist. But the one that I picked simply because there are like little bits of it that stand alone, you know, neatly and show what it is about these guys that is so funny, which is two dorky New Zealand white guys attempting to rap. Listen.
They call me the hip-hopopotamus, flows that glow like phosphorus, popping off the top of this esophagus, rocking this metropolis. I'm not a large water-dwelling mammal. Where did you get that preposterous hypothesis? Did Steve tell you that perchance? Steve.
Other rappers dismay, say my rhymes are sissy. Why
exactly?
What, why?
Be more constructive with your feedback, please. Why?
Why?
Why? Cause I rap about reality. Like me and my grandma drinking a cup of tea. There ain't no.
It's so deadpan. Be more constructive with your criticism, with your feedback. Plus the fact that some of that rapping is actually pretty intricate. And
it's better than some of the folks you'll find on Bandcamp these days.
Yeah. Yep. So that's Flight of the Conchords with Hip-Hopopotamus versus Rhymenoceros. So Flight of the Conchords, I think a shoo-in for our Funniest Songs Ever playlist.
That's pretty good. And like many of these songs, the videos have to be seen as well. And that's where we're putting most of our playlist, our mixtape, if you will, on soundcheck.org as a YouTube playlist so people can check out some of that hilarity as well. John, I have an Ask John Anything one that we can go out on.
Okay.
We had a listener, John, from Hillsborough. Let's see what he had to ask.
Hey there, this is John from Hillsborough, New Jersey. There was a tune, I don't know who did it, but it was Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road.
John, do you know who did
that song? Oh man, do I ever. He's been here a number of times over the years, and that is Loudon Wainwright III.
A generally hilarious songwriter.
Yeah, but this was like a big hit for him early on in his career, so nice call.
Crossing the highway late last night, he should've looked left and he should've looked right. He didn't see the station wagon car, the skunk got squashed, and there you are. You got your dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Stinking to high heaven. Take a whiff on me, that ain't no rose. Roll up your window and hold your nose. You don't have to look and you don't have to see, cause you can feel it in your olfactory. You got your dead skunk in the middle.
A little bit of Dead Skunk from Loudon Wainwright III, another nominee for our Funniest Songs Ever playlist, which our producers Katie Bishop and Dan O'Donnell have been curating. And guys, thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
See a full playlist on our website at soundcheck.org. Up next, you can stop holding your nose. We'll catch our breath and calm down by listening to a recent laid-back session with the indie rock band Real Estate. Songs from their latest album, Atlas, are coming up next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All the way back in January, the New York by way of New Jersey band Real Estate joined us to preview some of their highly anticipated new album, Atlas. The record went on to near universal acclaim this year, highlighting the band's breezy melodies and tight pop hooks. They'll be bringing their tour back to New York in a few weeks to play a big show at Terminal 5, but here they are in the Soundcheck studio with a version of their song, Talking Backwards.
Still
Band Real Estate, live on Soundcheck. The song is Talking Backwards. And let me introduce you to the members of Real Estate. Martin Courtney on vocals and guitar. Hey, Martin.
Hello.
Matt Mondanelli playing guitar. Alex Bleeker on bass. Jackson Paulus behind our drum kit. Matt Coleman playing the keyboards. Martin, the last two times you guys were on was right around the release date of the first two records. And if memory serves, it looks like you guys have gotten bigger since the last time you were here.
Right. Yeah, well, we've, I guess, expanded our lineup, yeah. Got a new
keyboard
player.
Accommodate a new sound or a depth of songwriting? What was the reason?
I think we've always had keys on the records, and it's just nice to have, you know, that extra depth when you play live. It just fills it out a little bit, and, you know, Matt had some nice parts. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the texture of your records, you know, has always had, I mean, people use sort of comparisons to 1970s FM rock and the sounds of bands like, I don't know, Death Cab for Cutie and people like that, you know, all these jangly guitars and the shimmering keyboards and stuff. Has that, you know, stayed pretty consistent even as you head on through this third record?
Yeah. I mean, I think... our sound is kind of something that we sort of found pretty early on, and
right.
We've kind of, it comes pretty naturally to us. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, we didn't kind of make any decisions to do anything drastically different this time.
Yeah, although people have remarked on the sunny nature of the first couple of records, and Atlas has a couple of tracks, especially as you get further into the record, where there might be a few clouds in the sky there.
Yeah, I feel like people say that about us, that our music is kind of sunny and summery. And yeah, I mean, I think our sound spans all seasons, you know? I mean, but I do think, yeah, there are some darker songs on this record for sure.
The album's called Atlas. Now, Atlas as a title could either mean the guy who literally has the weight of the world on his shoulders, or it could also mean, you know, a kind of a map.
I think that's kind of more of the reference for us, and it's sort of, it refers more to like the actual physical, you know, object of like a book that you hold that kind of, you know, helps you get around mm-hmm. kind of deal, yeah.
Well, now you guys, you came out of the suburbs of New Jersey, Ridgewood, but last time you were here, you'd all moved to New York. Do you still identify as a Jersey band?
Yeah, well, I mean, three of us grew up in New Jersey. You know, now we have members that are from different... Jackson's been in the band for a while. He's from New York, and Matt is from the Bay Area. So, mm-hmm. I mean... But, yeah, I think...
And other Matt has just moved to L.A.
And the other Matt just moved to Los Angeles.
You need an atlas just to know where everybody is. Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, we identify as hopefully kind of belonging to a lineage of bands that come, you know, hail from New Jersey originally.
Right. Now, the album Atlas was recorded in Chicago at Wilco's studio.
Yes.
Now, is Wilco one of those kind of touchstone bands for you guys?
I mean... Yeah, like I definitely have been through some heavy Wilco phases for sure. And I think it's mostly their records for us, I think, sound really, really great. They have really, really nice sounding records, and we were trying to, I think, step it up a little bit with this album and make, you know, a better sounding album.
You know, the funny thing with Wilco is they've been through so many different phases. You know, they haven't been, like, the same-sounding band all the way through. Right. And in recent years, they've sort of been mining a lot of, it seems, the same territory that you guys have been...
They're a good band. They're a good band.
So when you guys got into the studio, was the idea that we're going to just go in as a band, sit down as a band, and kind of do this almost live to tape, or... You know, was it the more conventional, I'll track my part, you track your part, we'll put the drums and the vocals in later, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it was definitely more the former. Like, we spent a couple months before going into the studio just rehearsing as a band and getting the songs arranged and getting all of our parts together. So when we went into the studio, we were pretty much ready to sit down and just play it, which is how we did it, yeah.
It's the band Real Estate performing live on Soundcheck and a song called The Bend. That is the band Real Estate, live in the Soundcheck studio with a song called The Bend. And each time the band has played here in the studio, they've done an instrumental track for us. And today will be no exception. Here is the instrumental track called April Song. Band Real Estate, playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio as they have done for each of their three albums. And every time, Martin, you guys have done an instrumental track for us.
That's right.
The rock instrumental, the pop instrumental, you know, it's sort of a
dying art. I mean, it gets resurrected in unexpected ways every now and again, but...
Yeah, I mean, we just have had one on every record, yep, and we like to, you know, keep that going. It's kind of fun.
Now, do you are you a big fan of the surf guitar sound, Dick Dale, The Ventures, that sort of thing?
I mean, like, not to the, you know, point that I actually know that much about it, but but yeah, I mean, I think especially early on, it was like something that we thought sounded cool, and yeah, for sure, like. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that piece, you know, that's just, I mean, some might say it's swimming in reverb. Yeah. I would say it's swimming in the sound of the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, it makes its way, I think, definitely into some of my guitar playing and, you know, just like using the whammy bar and things like that for sure.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you about the artwork for the new album, because you've been teasing bits and pieces of this on your Instagram account.
Right.
And it turns out...
Yeah,
it's all part of a mural, is that right?
Yeah, it's the cover of the record is most of a mural that used to hang on the side of a department store in Paramus, New Jersey, called Alexander's. It was there up until like the mid-90s. We used to drive past it every day, and it was just this huge, massive mural from the 60s that eventually got torn down.
Wow.
But yeah, the actual department store was defunct pretty much the entire time I was alive. So it was just this old building.
Oh, I remember Alexander.
Yeah.
I had a summer job at Alexander's. Yeah. Not the one in Paramus, the one in Manhattan.
Okay, but. Yeah.
But that's going back a few years.
Right,
so.
It's been...
So how did you get... If the building's long gone, the mural's long gone, how did you get it?
We just... I kind of remembered it, and then we thought it was a cool idea to use maybe part of it for the album cover, and I kind of scoured Google Image to find a... decent, you know, picture of it, and then we got in touch with the owner of the image, and, you know, like, we were able to make it work, yeah.
All right. The album called Atlas from the band Real Estate. They've been with us on Soundcheck. It's always great to have you guys with us, and congratulations on the new record.
Thank you. Thanks for having us back.
Was our January session with the band Real Estate. They're playing here in New York at Terminal 5 on October 2nd. Monday on the show, the actor Jeff Goldblum is known for his roles in The Big Chill, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, The Fly, and many, many others. But did you know he's an excellent jazz pianist as well? He'll join us here in the studio with his band to strut his stuff. Plus, I get an opportunity to geek out about David Bowie, but it's totally legitimized by the fact that I'll be doing it with a philosophy professor. Simon Critchley teaches at the New School here in New York, and his latest book is a sprawling meditation on the musical genius of Bowie. We'll talk about it and maybe even get a few Bowie tunes in edgewise Monday on the show. That does it for Soundcheck today. I'm John Schaefer.